So the Lighthouse then, I mean, much of those $30 million were because of the income from 7th and Howard, the Resnick Center, Buchanan Street, and continued wills and bequests, and restraint, Anita's restraint on spending in order to build that portfolio.
Correct. But then the kind of revitalization of the fundraising section. George, I'm not going to remember his last name, was hired as their fundraising director. And he was a very gregarious, likable, pretty knowledgeable kind of fundraising person. And he and Anita worked very, very well together. And he began to revitalize the fundraising efforts of the Lighthouse that had been pretty much diminished when through Kamini's last couple, 3 years here.
One of the things that we still, we've heard in years and decades past is individual people who lament the closure of Buchanan Street, the sort of drop-in community center house where you can come in and be kind of taken care of and all of that. That closed too, and was whatever was going on there was centralized at 214. Can you tell us what we had there? What did we lose and what did we gain from closing Buchanan Street?
What the Lighthouse lost, I think, was they had, I don't know how it was structured, but I would say a contract or an agreement with the San Francisco Community College District, or adult education, it might have been. And there were 6 part-time teachers paid, that worked for the Lighthouse, worked at the Lighthouse. They didn't work for the Lighthouse. They worked at the Lighthouse, paid by the adult education or community college district. They, most of them did not have a background in special education or blindness particularly. You know, they were good teachers. But what they basically did was perpetuated this is a nice, comfortable place to come 5 days a week. Transportation was provided, a meal was provided every day, and it made it a very comfortable place to be. And you could learn Braille if you wanted to. The Lighthouse store was there. Eventually we moved that. But and prior to the closure of Buchanan Street, we tried several years, particularly during the summer, to place people came to Buchanan Street in community senior centers, and provided a lot of staff support to the senior centers, where one individual or maybe two might be persuaded to go that was nearer their home. That was an attempt to kind of break the pattern of people coming to a really nice building and with friendly people and good food and spending their day.
And if you could just spell it out for me, what's wrong with a happy home for the blind? Every community has a group of people who would love to go to a center and spend time there together and be served in the way that Buchanan Street served blind people. What's wrong with that model?
In my view, 2 things are wrong with it. It did not encourage people as much as many of us thought they could have been encouraged to learn more skills so they could do more things independently. I would say that was one of the things. And then it was a blind center. I mean, there were sighted people there, but it was a center for the blind. And what most of us, or many of us, believed, and still do, is that, you know, we live in a sighted world, and yes, we need specialized things and specialized training, and it's fine for blind people to hang out with blind people, but should that be 5 days a week, and the only place that people go, except maybe for church? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Were there protests when Buchanan Street closed?
Not that I'm aware of. Again, I wasn't here, so not that I know of.
And when did you rejoin the Lighthouse as a member of the Board of Directors?
I think about 95, 94, 95, 96, somewhere in there.
And you eventually became president?
Yes, in probably, I guess I could have checked my notes, but probably 08 or 09, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. So talk about what did the board wrestle with in the mid-90s, late-90s, early 2000s? What were some of the issues going on as Anita, was then in full stride of what became a 19-year administration at the Lighthouse? What was the Lighthouse aspiring to do then?
Well, fundraising, of course, was a major focus. And the struggle of what do we fund and what would we not fund? And that really created some discussions about some of the things that were thought to be more paternalistic and carryovers from the past, and should that continue?
Such as?
Well, such as a nice home for seniors.
Yeah.
I mean, that I would say that was really the focal point. The direction that began to develop was then putting more emphasis on services for youth, not, weekend kinds of things, evening things. And it didn't really get going too much, but there was some real interest in trying to do that. And that kind of, in a way, tied in with the camp. Because the camp, was continuing to go, and it expanded. There was some remodeling done. Some of the cabins were rebuilt. The dining hall was upgraded some. And then off-season rental of the camp was tried. I mean, even as far back as when O.J. was there, we were trying to do that. And that was still in the 90s struggling with trying to develop it as a retreat center. From my vantage point, that never really caught. There were some rentals that came in, some groups came in, but it never really caught on the way that we hoped that it would.
Mm-hmm. I'd heard that Anita was never really sure that the Lighthouse should continue camp. She was sort of mixed opinion about it.
I don't know if I saw that so much. I mean, she knew of the history and the tradition, the bad reputation that the Lighthouse had in the 60s and 70s over the guide ropes had subsided pretty much by then. The guide ropes were seen as helpful guides to get around camp, but not as the only way you could get around camp.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, Anita put a lot of energy into it. It was around that time that, I forget what the organization was called, but that the day-to-day running of the camp was contracted out.
UCCR.
UCCR, that's right. And when that happened, that was one of the person that really kind of held the camp together for a number of years was Cinto Sola. He was an ex-Marine. He was there when I came to the lighthouse, and he was really the rock in the camp. I mean, he lived there on the camp, at the camp. He and OJ got along very well together. I think he died in 93 or 94, and it would be really difficult to find somebody as one purpose that was dedicated as Sola was in running a place, not running it, but overseeing it as Sola was. And I think that was one of the reasons that led to contracting with UCCR.
Mm-hmm. I hear what you say about the agenda of discipline, fundraising, and restraint of spending, and sort of a philosophical just turning away from the senior daycare, maybe a middling success with youth programs. What else at the Lighthouse was in this period from the mid-90s to the mid-2006, 2007, 2008? What other things did the Lighthouse do that were significant?
Oh, the workshop, of course. The workshop that the Lighthouse originally had from the 1920s, we closed in 81, and that was located at Howard Street. And we did everything we could to help those who were in the shop, working in the shop, who wanted to get a job outside, and a few did. So the workshop closed, and one of the things that my community did was to reestablish a workshop through the National Industries for the Blind, and that would have been in 86 or 87. I mean, that was beginning to emerge when I left, I think 88. And it was located over in West Oakland. It was an IB manufacturing contract work, employing four or five or six people, many of whom, well, not many, but some of whom I knew. They were in fairly seriously involved with other issues, fairly capable of doing contract work, but other than that, their life was pretty limited. The contracts were written so, though, that funds were generated by the NIB contracts. Pretty significant amounts of money every year went into the general operating budget.
And this was the toilet tissue plant? Or was there something in West Oakland before the toilet tissue?
I think, as I recall it, the toilet tissue was the big deal. It was the main contract, leading to we had a company come in and design equipment that would automate the making of toilet tissues of the size in the packets that the government wanted. And it was an expenditure of, I don't know, $100,000, a couple hundred thousand bucks, maybe even more than that. I don't recall now for sure. But that was one of the reasons, because the machine had to be fed, and then at the other end, everything boxed. And that's what those four or five or six people did. And the machine was fast, so the people were as fast as they had to be. I'm overly simplifying this, I think, but it was a source of money for the lighthouse.
Yeah. And that continued on West Poplar in Oakland, that lighthouse industries for almost 25 years until we moved it to San Leandro, which is another chapter to the story.
Right.
What do you think, personally, from the vantage point of 2018, about those kinds of jobs and that kind of operation for blind people?
I thought it was lighthouse energy and expertise and influence misplaced. I was pretty active on the program committee looking, and we've spent quite a few sessions talking about what kinds of services we might want to offer, particularly employment services. And what became pretty clear in looking at the employment patterns and the opportunities for anybody in the Bay Area is less and less emphasis on manufacturing and hands-on work, production line type things. And an entry wage for most people in the $12 to $15 an hour range, not for everybody, of course. The minimum wage was below that. But kind of the standard wage was up in that range. And that was not what blind people could enter without experience. That was not an employment market they could get into.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that was tried, a couple of different programs to train some train blind folks in different occupational areas, such as, I don't even remember what some of them were anymore, but they never caught.
Digital data scan.
That was one, yes.
Court reporting.
Yes. Yeah. Probably most emphasis was placed on those two, and it was again in partnership. The court reporting was in combination with an organization in Texas, I think, where they had a similar kind of training program, but a very different community employment situation than mm-hmm. we had here in the United in the Bay Area. And I don't know how well run they were, but the relationship with the Lighthouse and the Department of Rehabilitation was never terribly good. And, you know, the clients coming into those programs would almost by definition have to come through the Department of Rehab. And their counselors they didn't have a real high regard for the agency.
Why was that?
I don't know. There was some real opposition going way back to the workshop. Some with good reason and some not such good reason. And again, it was at that time when the shift away from trying to get people employed was beginning to take hold with the department. I know in the early 60s, the Lighthouse had several contracts, training programs that were funded, I don't know by whom. Switchboard training was one, when switchboards were answered by people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, counselors like myself would refer people to the agency because the training programs were pretty good. And there was some placements made from that. But that diminished, and the agency just didn't have a good reputation. I don't know, I'm not as familiar with what it is now, but my guess is it's not a lot different.
Mm-hmm. Especially, I want to talk about employment, because this is the heart of rehab. This is your personal expertise leading the National Center on Employment for AFB and leading many other things, SB 105 and many of the other actions over the years. Why is it that apart from running a broom shop in past years and some dedicated NIB contracts that got half a dozen blind people hired, in this period now, we're talking about the 90s, 2000s, why is it that the Lighthouse never got so much traction on employment and particularly competitive employment? If rehab says this is what it wants, if Lighthouse says this is really the center of the kind of life that we want to encourage blind people to have, why is it that the efforts historically have been kind of thin?
I always felt, and this goes back to what I would call the good old days with the Department of Rehab and when we were vocational counselors, our job was to go out and develop job open opportunities, go meet with employers, do job surveys, pass that information on to prospective clients who were ready to go to work. And you know, in working with the client and with the rehab counselor, that's a one-on-one kind of thing, and we really could never get that's kind of an old traditional model of employment assistance, I guess.
Doesn't that go back to Bob Campbell?
Oh, absolutely. Bob Campbell and George Fogarty.
Now you're talking the 1920s, 30s, 40s, right?
Yep. And the training program that changed my life in that regard was run at Southern Illinois University. It was a six-week training program for developing job opportunities. And the emphasis was on get your butt out there and talk to employers so you know what's going on in the employment market. You know what employers want. If you can develop a relationship with a particular employer, your likelihood, if you can find a person that matches the skills that employer wants, that person's going to go to work. And that just never caught. Never caught very much with the Department of Rehab. Several of the counselors from the Department of Rehab went through that training program in Illinois. I was one of them. And it changed my life. It changed how my perspective on employment. I think then and certainly now that's considered as old-timey. It's not what an agency, getting somebody out there talking to employers is not what employment people should be doing.
What do you think?
I think they should. I do for two reasons. One, I knew a lot about what employers wanted and what jobs required because I talked to employers. I went to the factories, I went to the hospitals, I went to the offices. I did as much as I was allowed to do job surveys so that I knew from day to day what a receptionist or what a nurse or whatever position you're talking about would be expected to do, what kind of working conditions they were in. that information has to be fed back to job seekers because they don't know. And helping the job seeker develop a realistic goal, job goal, has to be based on that kind of firsthand real information. And that's not a popular view. It's hard work, and it takes a certain kind of person, I suppose, to want to do that. But I'm not tooting my own horn here, but I have to say that even now, when I walk into a place, I'm always looking at, I wonder what that person does over there. I want to know, you know, what do they do? What are they expected to do? And then the point of the training program in Illinois was, and what can the potential worker and the counselor figure out to work around the things that require sight? Can they be exchanged? Can technology help? Can that particular task that requires sight, can that be shifted to somebody else and the blind worker take on something else to trade? But you've got to know what's going on day to day in the employment site if you're going to do stuff like that.
And why is it that you've said it a few minutes ago, rehab counselors, they don't go out anymore. They don't meet with businesses. They don't do exactly those things that you said you did. Why are we at this juncture?
I don't know. I think it's a combination thing. One, although I'm certainly one who's in favor of education and stuff, when I started with the department, I happened to have a master's degree, but it wasn't in job counseling. It was in counseling. It had nothing to do with the employment market. Most of the counselors, when I started to work, had done other kinds of work, and for whatever their reasons, they decided to kind of work as a rehab counselor. So they came in with firsthand knowledge of the workplace. When the master's degree was mandated, the emphasis was shifted to you had to have the MS. You have to have the degree. And that's all well and good. That in combination with, I think, more emphasis on documenting what you're doing,
yep.
Paperwork, if you will, detracts from... If you're worried about you're not documenting stuff, you're not going to think that spending time chit-chatting with a foreman is something you should be doing.
Over the time you served on the board and board president and even before, you got a chance to meet a lot of extraordinary personalities at the Lighthouse, in the wider blind biz. Who are some people that you will always remember? Maybe people who are unsung heroes or people who show a remarkable side of being in this field that you'd like to remember. Which people come to mind?
Well, of course, the guy that hired me, Jim Caywood, an insurance exec from back east and got hired as director, and he didn't know much about blindness.
Director of the Lighthouse.
Yep.
Yeah.
But he was an extraordinary person, and he was farsighted and very dedicated to running an agency and empowering managers and staff to do what they could do well. An extraordinary person. A man who was the board president when Jim Caywood left, that I worked a lot with, and I'm embarrassed because I don't remember his name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, Hugh Scott. He was a board president. He was also, he ran a business in San Francisco, and he was pretty well off. He was the kind of person that knew how to lead and inspire people from the board president's position. He knew other people that had money, and he was willing to challenge board members that I'll put up $15,000 for the lighthouse. How about you? But just because it was really tough times when Caywood left, and then when the next director left, and relying on Hugh Scott, because I was acting exec at that time, he had my back. I knew it. And it was just an incredible kind of guy to be with. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated him a great deal. I would have to say Anita, in her way, and in the time that she was here, was, although we had our differences of opinion on some issues, she worked too many hours. somebody. No more dedicated person could you find than Anita. Same thing with OJ. She had such a good way with counseling, with the counselors at camp and running the camp, and not being in the midst of it, but she was the leader and everybody knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And people had a lot of regard for her and should have. She wasn't so much of a strategist, but boy, she was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you always knew that. Those are some of the folks that jump into my head.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the Lighthouse board, and I'm wondering, who was the first blind board president?
That would be Mike Cole. I'm almost sure I'm right about that. And I think Mike was board president even before I joined the board. He and Anita were, worked very well together. And he was on the board. At that time, you could be on the board forever if you wanted to be. One of the changes that I helped bring about was term limits, because I felt as good as guys like Mike Cole and others were, they needed to rotate off and make room for new people. And so that's when we put in the term limits. But I think Mike was the first mm-hmm. blind pres.
Even though he did have the same term limit as anybody else, you can find him this afternoon upstairs on the 10th floor talking to a group of students about blindness. He does this for us every week.
Yes.
Still.
Yes. I know. I know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Mike was followed by Barbara Lassen. I think she was next. There might have been another prez in there in between. But then Barbara, and then I was prez, and then since then you've had some others as well.
Yeah, with the amount that the Lighthouse has grown in reach and in staff size and all that, what do you think the importance is to have a president of the board of directors who's blind?
I think that should be one of the characteristics, not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find somebody who is organizationally wise and good with working with other people, and they're also blind, you've got a winning combination. But sighted people come with those qualities too.
Yep.
But it's that mix. I mean, I gotta remember his name. The guy that was president just before I was. He was on the board for. He worked down on Second Street at an investment place.
Are you talking about Todd Stefanot?
Stefanot. Todd, business guy, you know, family man for sure, but he had so many. I guess I would add him to the names of people that I think highly of, just because he had such an even way of handling things. I recall when he was. Well, when we recruited you in here, he ran the selection committee, and maybe he was president then. I think he was. Anyway, he ran it so well, you know. And he could see. So
yeah. So now I want to ask you to be candid as you look into the future. You've seen a lot of blindness agencies. You've seen a lot of good practices, and you've seen agencies lose their way as well. Here we are at the Lighthouse now. We're larger, we're richer, we have bigger aspirations. We also have lost some things that previous administrations have had. What would you advise for us? What would you like to see the Lighthouse grow towards that we're not yet there? What growth do we need? What would make us serve the blindness community in the best possible way?
Well, the first thing that jumps in my mind, and it's because of my background, is I know the Lighthouse has an employment program, and I haven't heard much of it lately, and that worries me, because employment is such a critical thing, and I don't know if I were in your spot, how I would want to structure it, given all the realities of one of the major supplying sources of clients, the Department of Rehab.
Mm-hmm.
But I would look at it this way. I think the emphasis that the Lighthouse is putting on technology and the MAT lab and all the good stuff, the deafblind grant and so forth, and the good quality of training technology that exists, I think that's fine. The day begins by tying your own shoes and walking out the door and having a belief in yourself. And that has nothing to do with technology. I mean, technology can help it. But I worry that the Lighthouse is getting too hip, if you will, or too much into the 21st century, and that, not that I would want to go back to the days of offering a nice warm place for old people to come and be every day, not that at all, but there is a balance there that has to be achieved between nurturing and providing good basic support, training, and just being a nice place to be at. And not that this isn't a nice place to be at, because it is, but it's there's a balance there. I guess is what I'm getting at. And it, to me, it becomes most evident when I think about employment and what is or isn't happening.
Where in the world have you seen organizations or practices that make it more likely that people will tie their own shoes and get up and own their own lives? What is a practice or an organization to emulate there?
Well, again, I'm, you know, I've been away from the operations of agencies and stuff for over 10 years now. And so what I would currently know is not, probably not so up to date. But when I look back at agencies that I thought came as close to that as they could, the Chicago Lighthouse certainly did. Probably the Seattle Lighthouse, they did. And then the training programs that, although I have my differences of opinion with them, that NFB runs, you know, they do teach people how to tie shoes, and to be their own advocates and to believe in themselves and to believe that blind people can do stuff. And, you know, I have to say, I think they come with some things I disagree with, but the core of it for the centers that NFB runs in particular, I think is very, very solid. And that's what I saw at the Chicago Lighthouse, the same thing. In a different way, of course, because it's a public agent, you know, private agency, and didn't house people and stuff like that. But they carried that forth.
And now that you're almost 81 yourself, and speaking about not providing that happy home for the blind. We talked earlier about your active life, bicycling, your own workshop, not an employment workshop, but woodworking workshop, all of that. What is the role of an agency for seniors who are in their 80s and 90s who may not have an employment path? We can say we're not doing Buchanan Street anymore, or we're not having $2 subsidized lunches and somebody brings you coffee. But can we just leave it there? Or is there a way that we can continue to be a vital place for people who are blind, who are in their post-working years, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond? What could we do that doesn't custodialize or diminish the dignity of blind people there?
Well, although it may not attract people quite of the age you're talking about, but I think the senior self-reliance program that the Lighthouse has been running, both here and at camp, the philosophy of that is what I think is correct. That is, giving people the skills, the encouragement, the support, and the caring, and that they need to become as self-sufficient as they can. And if they don't meet those things, well, then they don't. And having some respectful place to come that they feel comfortable at, I think is a good thing. And although I love San Francisco and I love this building, that's not what I would think about coming to every day and curling up in a corner someplace. I guess that reflects my more rural background too, because this is a, you know, it's a big place, and it's on three floors, and it's the people here are fine. It has nothing to do with the people, but just the size and scope of it. It's you have to be pretty mobility-wise capable of getting around, even just to come here and go to the bathroom and go find the coffee. And for all of its limitations, Buchanan Street was much more user-friendly, if you want to put it that way. So whether something at Ed Roberts could be developed on the first floor to meet that, or in the community someplace, I don't know. I don't know. That's tricky. That's hard. I know that. But I think it has to be someplace where people don't have to worry about, let's see, where are those stairs? Oh, they turn and they turn and they turn. And where in the heck is the restrooms? I forgot where they are. And where's that water fountain? I heard there is one. In a building of this size, that you really have to have your wits about you to do those things. So I don't know.
Yeah, so we have this tension between what has become a large blindness center with qualities, some of qualities like a startup, some like a foundation, some like a training center. But it may be that the vital parts of blindness happen over a picnic table at camp or in a small satellite location. We're playing with those things in the future to keep things human scaled. In these three conversations we've had with you, Gil, the role of mentors and people who cared just at the right time in your life strikes me. And I think part of our responsibility at the Lighthouse is to make sure that we design the spaces and we don't over-program and over-commit to such a point that the magic of a chance encounter, or for somebody who wants to spend a little time, gets squeezed out.
Well said. I absolutely agree with that. And the one piece that you just mentioned, that mentors having, they can be blind people, other blind people, or they can be sighted folks. I don't draw a line there, but having somebody like that around, so that the person who is 80 and just lost some vision, or 75 or whatever age, who really doesn't know what's going on in the world, can have there to talk to. My son-in-law's brother is in that position. He's in a program in Kansas or in Missouri, and I don't know anything about the program, so I can't even comment on that. But my son-in-law asked me to talk to him on the phone, and I've done that a couple of times, and he knows me somewhat, this guy does, and just trying to reinforce in his thinking, don't think so much about the things you can't do, think about the things you can do, and then, you know, try to build the skills so you can expand that list. But hearing that, at least from what this guy says, is he finds very reinforcing. And yeah, we talk about technology and stuff, but it's really one person to another person, and in this case, somebody who's walked that route. I mean, I know what it is to be blind, and this guy is trying to learn, and he doesn't want it. He doesn't want to be blind. Of course he doesn't. Who does? But he is, and okay, bring your skills, bring your strengths, bring your capabilities. You're a heck of a nice guy. Yeah, I know, you get lost in the room, but you can think. And I think his hearing that, in this case over the phone, will help him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gil Johnson, I want to thank you for this part three of three parts, some of your reflections about your long 60-year career in blindness and some of the lessons that we can take hold of long into the future here at the Lighthouse. I want to thank you, and I know you won't be a stranger, but I appreciate your time here sharing with us.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Brian, and I appreciate the way you ask questions. I would wish more people could do that.
All right.